This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Isabel Hardman. We've had some news this morning, perhaps unsurprising news, in the sense that Boris Johnson has now cancelled his trip to India. It looked as though the Prime Minister might be forced into doing this. A few days ago, however, Number 10 were insisting it would go ahead, but with rising COVID cases and a crisis in India, the Prime Minister has now said it's not a sensible time to go. Isabel, this is supposed to be a year of global leadership for Boris Johnson's government, G7, and being one part of that as well as COP26. But do you think this India trip is an example of why that's just so hard to really do when we're still very much in a global pandemic?
Yeah, I think we're going to see a debate throughout this year about Zoom diplomacy and whether or not it's possible to maintain, at the very least, relationships like the important relationship that Boris Johnson wants to maintain between Britain and India, to do that remotely. And we've had a call today from the Foreign Affairs Committee for more of the meetings at COP26 to also be conducted over Zoom, using remote conferencing rather than face-to-face meetings, in a message about low-carbon negotiating. There's been a pushback from that, saying, well, actually, you know, a lot of the progress at these summits is made when you get countries that disagree with one another together in the sort of the private meeting rooms, rather than these very stilted video calls that everyone's got used to over the past year. But I think, as everyone in the country is going through a debate about how much of their job they can and should do remotely, you're going to see that over the next year, because we don't have a resolution to the pandemic yet, even though leaders are impatient to get back out on the global stage, even though Boris Johnson has got a lot of relationships that he wants to build, particularly following Brexit. I think that there is going to be this debate about, well, why couldn't this summit take place over Zoom? That was certainly the point that Labour was making before this India visit was cancelled.
We know that the UK has been dealt a few blows in terms of supply, but not so much that we have ministers saying that the whole pace or the roadmap is going to be slowed down. Now, James, if the UK cannot get these AstraZeneca vaccines from India, and given the situation in India finds itself in, it's probably very politically difficult in a way to a domestic audience to do that. Is that going to have an effect that we feel in terms of when things are opening up, or actually do several more things have to go wrong to get there?
I think that the planning at the moment, I think it would be a bonus if these vaccines were to end up arriving in the UK. I think that, you know, follow very closely what happens with the CDC's decision on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. There appears to be a kind of slightly similar issue to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine on blood clots. And the question is whether that, you know, Rupert Beale, who's written for The Spectator previously, suggests that this is due to the way in which both vaccines work, why they appear to have, they work in a very similar way, which is why it appears that they might have the same problem. I think if you have something affecting younger people's vaccination involving two of those vaccines, that could, at the very least, require some rejigging in terms of which vaccine is offered to the younger cohort. Previously, the hope was that the target would be beaten. I think now the hope is that the target will be met.
Now, this weekend, we also had the end of the period of mourning for the Duke of Edinburgh, with Prince Philip's funeral taking place. Isabel, last week we had debates in the Common Chamber of tributes for Prince Philip, but now, what is the aftermath of this going forward?
Well, I think one of the things that the funeral has probably reignited, or at least should reignite, is a greater awareness of the importance of the Commonwealth. Because I think one of the reasons that the Queen sitting alone wearing a mask was such a powerful image around the world was that, my understanding was that she wanted to send a message to the rest of the Commonwealth that she was taking this fight against coronavirus as seriously as they were having to. And it's something that's very little discussed within Westminster. But I think the importance of the Commonwealth to the Queen, and also that image of her sitting alone, has obviously been beamed around the world and has been very moving for a lot of people. I think it's her sort of moment, a bit like her mother saying that she could look the East End in the face after Buckingham Palace was bombed in the war, that the Queen has sort of been going, has had some experience of the same suffering that a lot of people in this country and around the world have had, of not being able to say goodbye to their loved ones in the way that they'd like during this pandemic. And I think that's probably the sort of long-term implication of that.
James?
I think Isabel is right. I think one of the things that gives monarchy its emotional power is that it is a family, and so it goes through similar things that other families go through. I suspect that every family that has had to have a funeral in these COVID times, with these restrictions in place, probably feels a kind of greater sense of fellow feeling with the monarchy following those pictures of the Queen sitting alone. Obviously, it's the Queen's birthday coming up this week. You definitely get the sense that Buckingham Palace are very keen to emphasise that, you know, things will head back to normal quite quickly. There's, you know, and squash any talk, I think, of a kind of soft regency option being discussed. Again, to pick up on something that Isabel said about the Commonwealth, the position of head of a Commonwealth is not a hereditary position, although the Queen has it now, and there's obviously a clear desire in the royal family for Prince Charles to succeed when the time comes to that. And I think that will become an increasing focus of royal work in the coming years.
Now, finally, 3 weeks to go to the local elections. Isabel, when it comes to, I suppose, the big stories to expect from this, there's been a lot of focus on Scotland. People noting today that Boris Johnson was planning to go to India, but yet hasn't seemed to have too many imminent plans to head north of the border to campaign. Perhaps Nicola Sturgeon would not be happy if he did. How are things looking in terms of that one? Because clearly, if the SNP win a majority, it does create a world of problems for the UK government, ones that they know are on the horizon, but still difficult all the same.
Yeah, so we've got the launch of the Scottish Conservatives manifesto this morning, with pledges for 3,000 more teachers and a funding boost for the NHS, which sounds very suspiciously like Nicola Sturgeon's funding boost for the NHS that she announced a week or so ago. And Douglas Ross is launching it as a manifesto that uses the strong foundations of the UK to rebuild Scotland. It's interesting, I live in West Lothian, and the leaflets that I get through my door from the Scottish Conservatives are all, vote for us to stop a second independence referendum. Whereas the SNP leaflets are largely policy-based, with little references to independence at sort of the end of sentences. And so you can see the different groups that they're targeting. I haven't had an ALBA leaflet through yet, unfortunately, but the Scottish Labour leaflet, you'd be surprised to learn, sort of tries to do both and not very successfully, which I think sums up their problem.
James, when it comes to that message from the Scottish Conservatives that Isabel's talking about, it's interesting because a few months ago, the Scottish Conservatives were very keen to make this an election on domestic issues, partly because we saw in the 2019 general election, Scottish Conservatives really going on that line, which is, you know, vote for us to stop an independence referendum, and yet having a very difficult result. Although Boris Johnson won a majority of 80, the result in Scotland was a loss of several Scott Tory MPs. So why do you think they have switched tactics?
I think the reason why they're going so hard on IndyRef 2 is, frankly, the Scottish Tories don't have many other policies apart from being opposed to a second independence referendum. And I think that, you know, if you look at the revival in relative terms of Scottish Toryism since 2014 and the first independence referendum, it has all been based around being stridently opposed to a second independence referendum. Now, I mean, there are obviously two reasons why Boris Johnson, as you said, Katie, isn't going kind of north of the border to campaign. One is obviously his personal ratings in Scotland. And secondly, because there's a very difficult tightrope to walk, because the UK government line is, doesn't matter what happens in these Holyrood elections, there's not going to be a second Scottish independence referendum anytime soon. Now is not the right time. It would be reckless, and the UK government simply won't grant a Section 30 order. The Scottish Tories want to say, you've got to vote for us to stop this reckless referendum. The contradiction between those two positions is so apparent that I think if you sent Boris Johnson to Scotland for a day, it would become embarrassingly obvious. I thought when at the Scottish Tory conference, you know, Boris Johnson tried to kind of straddle these two positions. I think it is interesting because Scottish parliamentary elections, the campaigns often do matter. and the voting intention often shifts quite significantly during it. I'd be fascinated to know what Isabel feels on the ground, but from down here, it does feel like the campaign is not having that much of an effect at the moment. You're not seeing a big shift in terms of where votes are. And, you know, for example, kind of Anas Sarwar, the new Scottish Labour leader, is having a good campaign, but that doesn't appear to be having a dramatic effect yet on the Scottish Labour vote.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Isabel. And thank you for listening.